Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
The NBA playoffs are here, and we all know playoff mode is a thing. Listen to the evidence. Playoff crowds are going wild. Playoff players are lighting up the court. Even your speakers are in playoff mode. Okay, we'll take it down a notch, but just a notch, because this is the Turn It Up to 11 NBA playoffs. Playoff mode is clearly a thing. The NBA playoffs presented by Google Pixel continue on ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV.
Welcome to the Bike Radar podcast, brought to you by the team behind BikeRadar.com, Cycling Plus, and MBUK magazines. If you enjoy this episode, please subscribe. And if you can do so, leave us a rating on your podcast provider of choice. It really helps us reach other cyclists like you.
Welcome to the Bike Radar podcast. My name is George Scott, the editor-in-chief of Bike Radar, and we are back for our second round of Sea Otter Tech. We're focusing on mountain bike tech in this episode from North America's biggest bike show. Jack Luke, you're joining me once again. How are you?
I'm wonderful. I'm sat cross-legged on a bed in a very small hotel room with you, supping on a beer, talking about mountain bike tech. I can't think of a better way to spend a Saturday night, George.
We've got a slight change of setting. We were in our Airbnb in Monterey, a couple of hours south of San Francisco for the show. The show has now ended. We made our way back to San Francisco, so we're in a hotel room before our flight out tomorrow to talk oh-so-shiny mountain bike tech. These are some of your highlights from the show. We've got lots more on Instagram, coming on our YouTube channel, on the site. Go and check it out. We've got some tech highlights that Jack is going to take us through for mountain bikers. Jack, let's start with the Fox 32 Stepcast Fork. Now, this one was released, a week ago, but this was your first chance to see it in the flesh.
Yes, we had our very own Luke Marshall at the launch of this fork. Definitely one of the more divisive bits of mountain bike tech in recent years. The 32 Stepcast is Fox's cross-country racing fork, and up until now, it's been quite a conventional but essentially slimmed down mountain bike fork. The new one adopts a new reverse arch, which is very much in the style of Manitou's reverse arch forks. But in addition to that, it also has a really unusual zero offset crown. So most crowns, to get a bit of rake or offset into a fork, have the steerer tube sat behind where the stanchions join. This new fork instead has the stanchions in line with the crown of the fork, and then the stanchions themselves kind of leave at a slight angle from the fork. And it does honestly look pretty odd in the context of cross-country mountain bike forks. I'm not going to say bad. I personally think it looks quite cool. It's quite similar to the, I can't remember what it's called, the gravel fork from Fox. Can I remember what that's called?
Tapercast?
Tapercast, that is it, the Tapercast. It's quite similar to that, and it looks particularly good in the gold version we photographed on the site, but definitely one that had lips wagging in the comment section with the kind of wild, almost cut-out look of the crown. Yeah, definitely one that's not for everyone, but according to Fox, has resulted in a fork which is 40% stiffer compared to the previous generation, despite weighing just 1,287 grams, which is down from 1,443 grams. That is really nuts light for a very high performance fork. And finally, this one also uses the new Grip SL damper. I am not going to try and explain the damper tech well in this one. Luke did a fantastic job looking over all of this on the site in the news story for all the Fox's new dampers. And of course, you can find that in the podcast description.
For someone who's much more focused on curly bars, whether that's road or gravel, the reverse arch on this is really interesting. So what's the main reason that Fox are going for this reverse arch? Is it just that stiffness and weight, which are really key features?
Absolutely. They weren't hugely specific why they've gone for the reverse arch over another design. They simply said that as part of some new software they've got, which enables them to test lots and lots of different theoretical designs for the fork, this one gave them the right mix of riding characteristics while also being possible to manufacture. I think there's probably wilder designs they could have done to do all sorts of different things. But in terms of like the practicalities of manufacturing it, this was the one they could do. But they weren't really drawn on why the reverse arch was the right thing. This is absolute speculation. I'd have to check this. I wonder whether Manitou's reverse arch patent perhaps had come to an end, or perhaps their ability to produce that alone. I don't know. That might be complete nonsense. But yeah, it's definitely something Manitou did for a very, very long time. So it's interesting that Fox has now gone after all this time. Oh, maybe they were onto something after all. Yeah, an interesting one.
Maybe. And as you said, this is a Fox's XC fork. There is definitely going to be a cross-country theme throughout this year's mountain bike tech, what with the Paris Olympics coming up this summer. But we're going to move to our next product, and this one doesn't have an XC theme. We're going to come back to that, but this is Atherton's more affordable S-Range alloy bikes. Now, Atherton has been making waves over the last couple of years for its bonded frames, and these are something a little bit different.
Yes, so Atherton is best known to this date for its carbon and titanium bonded bikes. So with its A-Range bikes, which stands for additive manufacturing, titanium lugs are 3D printed with carbon tubes then bonded. They're really stunning bikes, Lego-like bikes, I dare say, Kinects even, that are really technically very advanced. But one of their key selling points is the wildly huge number of custom fit options available on all these bikes. Unsurprisingly, carbon and titanium frames 3D printed in the UK in Macunthlyth, probably doing a dreadful job of pronouncing that. But anyway, carbon and titanium frames, pretty expensive to manufacture, very, very high-tech stuff. This new S range of bikes, and thus far it's only one bike, uses aluminium tubing instead and aluminium lugs. The aluminium lugs are CNC machined as opposed to 3D printed, and then the tubing itself is bonded, as with the carbon tubes, into those lugs. The interesting thing about this is the actual like screwed and glued or bonded lugs and tubing is something that's been done for a very long time in cycling. Vetus did it first in the 70s with its 979 road bikes, because at the time it was the best way to make aluminium bikes. But as welding technology and so on improved and frame manufacturing like techniques advanced, this sort of form of construction fell out of favour. But according to Atherton, it does have some major benefits over other designs. The key one in this case for the alloy bike is it enables them to use 7075 tubing, which compared to more conventional alloy tubing, has higher ultimate and fatigue strength than conventional alloys. And other 7075 tubing cannot be welded, which is why this manufacturing technique enables that. But also, like with the carbon and titanium bikes, it's possible to create custom frame sizes and so on. More than anything though, I just think they're a bit different. They're very, very cool, and I don't think there's anything wrong with admitting the fact that these sort of very futuristic Robocop bikes have garnered attention for the fact they do look cool. But it is backed up with exceptional performance as well. I can't recall the score off the top of my head, but our own Luke Marshall, again, he reviewed the trail version of the carbon bike and was hugely complimentary about the bike. I really think these are proper rider's bikes with good looks to match.
Absolutely. I didn't see this bike, but I did see a second bonded bike at this year's Sea Otter. You were doing most of our mountain bike sleuthing, but I was sent to go and see this one by Rob Weaver, our technical editor-in-chief back at base in Bristol. And this was the prototype Frameworks downhill aluminium bonded frame of downhill pro Nico Mullally. Now, Nico has been building and racing his own bikes for a couple of years on a traditionally welded aluminium frame, but this one is altogether new. It's a prototype bonded frame. It was actually displayed on the Continental stand at the Sea Otter Classic with that bonded front triangle, so aluminium frames bonded into CNC machined lugs. As I said, the previous production downhill frame that Frameworks have produced, that's Mulally's brand, has previously used a welded construction. Now, this is very much a prototype. It's been put through lab testing by Frameworks and a company that they've been working with in Quebec, Canada, called Faction Bike Studio. That's an engineering company. Mulally is now doing lots of real world testing. So going out, riding on it, racing on it, seeing how it stands up to real world testing. So he says the main advantage of going bonded is that there are no heat affected zones. You can be more creative in the way that you make the bike compared to welding. There's also a weight saving because you're removing all of the additional material and faff that goes on around the lug. So a claimed weight saving of around 300 grams compared to the welded frame. And really interesting, really eye-catching bike. And actually a couple of other snippets that featured on this bike. It had a wireless, unreleased wireless Fox shock with a remote lockout on the handlebar and some unreleased Envy wheels, which we first saw on Brendan Fairclough's Scott Ransom a couple of weeks ago. So a real treat, this one. An unreleased bonded frame, unreleased wireless shock from Fox, and prototype Envy wheels.
Really cool frame. This isn't going to be a subject we could ever do justice to, George, but I think the bonded, lugged frame construction is definitely having, I'm not going to call it a comeback, but definitely a moment in cycling. Specialized, who have absolutely no history, that's not true actually, they do for their old road bikes in the 90s, but in recent times, they have no history of doing screwed and glued or bonded frames. They've been testing a prototype downhill bike for ages now, which was actually on show, and we'll include that in a future roundup. Really tasty name drop, but G. Atherton was in the queue getting coffee behind Scott and I when we were at the show, and I was kind of grilling him on, like, why do you think it's kind of making a comeback? And he reckons it's more than anything advancements in manufacturing techniques, which makes this a possibility. And that's all I have to say on the subject. I'm going to wait until someone way better qualified than me has the time and the energy to talk about it.
very smartly and swiftly moved on there, Jack. We're going to move on to Box Components. Box is a brand well known for its alternative drivetrain components, an alternative to the likes of Shimano and SRAM in the mountain bike market. So you saw the Box One drivetrain, and this is a premium 9-speed drivetrain designed for the rigors of eMTB riding.
Yes, quite unusual. So Box first brought a 9-speed, we'll call it premium drivetrain to market in 2019. It's Prime 9 drivetrain. This new one very much builds on that. But to be honest, there's not a great deal that is similar between them. The heart of this group set is that 9-speed cassette. It's machined from one piece of steel. It's super light at a claimed weight of 350 grams. It's available in a single 11 to 50 tooth option, and it's expected to cost around $400. It's a really lovely object. We've seen sort of one-piece steel cassettes for a very long time, but as a 9-speed option, it's pretty cool. The rear derailleur has also been updated, or changed rather, from a dual or slant parallelogram design, as you see with all of Shimano's derailleurs, to a horizontal parallelogram. So with Shimano's slanted parallelograms, if you imagine you're looking at a cassette from the back, they tend to move sort of up and down across the path of the cassette as they shift. Horizontal ones move, as the name suggests, in a more just left to right fashion. And that's how SRAM uses it or designs its derailleurs these days. Now, according to Box, this new design results in more accurate shifting with a less chance of ghost shifting. And they did admit that was something they suffered with a little bit with their previous generation group set. The internals of the shifter for the group set have also been upgraded from original plastic ratchets to magnesium, improving the longevity and shifter feel. One really cool thing on this, quite a bold move as well for a small brand, but the chain on Box's 9-speed drivetrains is proprietary, with the overall outer width the same as a 9-speed chain, but the inner width the same as an 11-speed chain. So the plates essentially are a bit thicker on this chain, which results, Box says, in a stronger drivetrain overall. Now, while this was shown on a, we'll call it analog, since we're in America, they like to describe them as analog bikes. An analog bike, this is really more than anything designed for the rigors of e-bike riding. It's not a particularly new idea. A few years ago, we saw SRAM's EX8. Yes, it was EX8 drivetrain. That was an 8-speed mountain bike drivetrain designed for e-bikes. This 9-speed one is a bit of a a refresh of that idea. So the 9-speed drivetrain just a bit harder wearing than 11-speed. And also with an e-bike taking up a lot of the, well, adding in some cases more power than you could possibly put out, that need for really refined small steps between gears is far reduced. So 11 and 12-speed is less important. This particular group set has an expected retail price of around $700. Just a little bit to be confirmed. They're quite keen to say that. Because availability is not going to be until later this year. And who knows, George, what will happen between now and then.
Is Box best described as a challenger brand?
In the mountain bike space, yes. It's actually probably better known as a brand in the BMX world, where it's pretty dominant in its BMX racing cred. They make really cool BMX. I know nothing about BMX tech, but I know it's cool. It's really, really nice stuff. So yes, in the mountain bike space, though, they want to sit very firmly alongside the likes of SRAM and Shimano. They're not like Mikeshift, for example, which wants to target a sort of budget-conscious lower end of the market. These want to be at the same level.
I was going to ask you if you've got BMX racing cred, but maybe you answered that.
Absolutely not. I don't think I've ever done a big jump in my life.
The NBA playoffs are here, and we all know playoff mode is a thing. Listen to the evidence. Playoff crowds are going wild. Playoff players are lighting up the court. Even the speakers are in playoff mode. Okay, we'll take it down a notch, but just a notch, because this is the turn it up to 11 NBA playoffs. Playoff mode is clearly a thing. The NBA playoffs presented by Google Pixel continue on ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV.
Want to be more active this summer? Sierra helps you save on everything from swimsuits to stand-up paddle boards, tennis rackets to fishing tackle. And if that doesn't float your boat, we also have pool floats. Sierra, let's get moving. To your local store, like now. Go!
Okay, we're going to move from drivetrain components to new pedals from Wolftooth. You saw these. I also went and had a look at these. Really cool looking pedals. These are the Wolftooth Ripsaw pedals. I think we've got some of these into test, but they've just been released. Wolftooth does have an existing set of pedals in the range, but these are a little bit different in terms of the riding position that they expect riders to adopt when using these.
Yes, they are very much designed for midfoot riding. I mean, it kind of says it all there, but people are talking more about pedal positioning for flat pedals now, and as a result, pedals as a general trend have got bigger and bigger. But yeah, midfoot riding has many advantages in control, but also for some people, we'll say ergonomically is better, or biomechanically is better. And that's reflected in the slightly convex profile of the pedals. They're just 7 millimeters thick at their leading edge, which is really, really thick, and only 12.5 millimeters thick at the axle. Very, very slim profile, but also visually from the top down, a very nice minimalist pedal. And the ones we photographed are in a really cool raw silver finished. Very, very nice. The pedals cost $200. They spin on 3 sealed bearings and an IGUS bushing, and they have 12 pins on either side, which can be swapped between 4.5 and 3.5 millimeter long options. There's nothing like absolutely extraordinary about these. There's definitely other flat pedals out there which are bigger or wilder or thinner. These just look like a really nice, cool, solid option. And one thing I really like about Wolftooth, and has garnered them lots of attention in the mountain bike world, is they sell replacement parts for everything they do. They very much believe in right to repair, so every single component on this pedal can be bought as a spare part, and I think that's really good.
Excellent. I saw some purple, a purple version of these pedals, and they also looked stunning, really nice. But we're going to quickly move on from Wolftooth, because that is a brand name that I struggle to say. And we're going to move on to Praxis. They also had some new pedals. These were the Podium pedals from Praxis, a little bit cheaper at $155, but equally interesting.
Yes, these will possibly look familiar to some readers, as they are, in fact, a re-release of Gamut's Podium pedals. Quite a divisive pedal, that. Had definitely had some fans. Our Alex Evans wasn't a massive fan, giving it a 2.5, but definitely it had a vocal people out there who really rated this. Quite an iconic pedal, I dare say. But anyway, Gamut went out of business around 2018, and Praxis said that they were in the middle of designing their own pedal and kind of realized, oh, like, this already existed and people really liked it. So they said they had a nice conversation with Gamut's old owners, who gave them their blessing to recreate this classic pedal with some little updates. So first things first, and one of the more interesting talking points of this pedal, For a boutique pedal, it's quite unusual that these are manufactured using forging prior to machining. So forging essentially sees two great big halves of a cookie cutter mold squashed down on a big lump of aluminium where they enter temporarily a liquid state, aligning the grain structure of an alloy. That's how Shimano's hubs are made, for example, and they've been long lauded for being stronger than others. It's a very, very, very expensive process to have that done. The dies, the tooling for making this is really expensive, but Praxis were at length explaining to me how much they like forging as a process. So they decided no compromises there in terms of the cost. But while there's good upfront cost, once you have got that sort of rough cast shape of the pedal, it's subsequently much easier to machine it to its final shape, which results in overall lower manufacturing costs if you're making them at volume. So these are quite a boutique premium pedal, but they are only $155, which, like, $45 is quite a bit cheaper than those Wolftooth pedals we just talked about. Like the Wolftooth pedals, they spin on three cartridge bearings and IGUS bushing. They're 14 millimeters thick at this widest point, but one of the kind of things that Alex called out in his review from 2016 or something, I think it was that the out or inboard edge of the pedal had a really big lump for the bearing. That's gone with this new pedal, and in theory should result in a more comfortable fit overall for the flat pedal shredders. Really nice one. The Praxis people, everyone's nice in the cycling industry. We've only had good conversations at CR, but they were really nerdy in the best possible way. They were very excited to talk to me about how these pedals and their cranks were made and left a lasting positive impression on me. So cool pedals and good people.
Good. People that come from, that share your sentiment when it comes to nerdy bike tech.
Absolutely.
You are right. 2016 for Alex's review of the Gamut podium pedals. Alex must have been a young whippersnapper at that point, 8 years ago now.
He still had as little hair as he has now, I'm sad to say.
Let's move on from that one. We're going to go back to XC. We mentioned at the start that XC, it's going to be a big year for cross country this year with the Olympic Games coming up in Paris at the end of July, start of August. Now, this is a new set of tyres from Maxxis. This is actually the second, or at least the second, cross-country tyre that was released at Ciotta. There's also the Vittoria Piotti, which we've covered on the site, but this is the Maxxis Aspen ST XC racing tyre. It's been used by pros for a couple of years now, but it's now finally available to the public.
Yes, this tyre is, like, it's almost comical to look at. It looks like it's worn out when you buy it. It has got a really, really, really low-profile tread. It's almost like a cyclocross file tread. So the Aspen to date has been Maxxis's fastest tire, cross-country tire, I should say. Fairly conventional, low-profile tread. This totally does away with that central tread, going instead for this sort of staggered file tread than these very low-profile chevrons, essentially like a semi-slick, to be honest. And then on the cornering lugs, we have the same lugs as seen on the regular Aspen. Now, this has been raced for quite some time, as mentioned, but the tyre is now essentially finally available for purchase by the public. It's available in a limited edition 170 TPI casing option, which is really unusual for a mountain bike tyre. That's like road bike tyre levels or levels of casing. But the conventional one is going to be 120 TPI casing option, both of which very supple in the context of mountain bike tyres. The 170 TPI casing version is going to be $101 and the conventional 120 TPI casing option at 93, and both of those are available in a 2.25 or 2.4 inch option. A very, very, very specialist tire. I mean, Maxxis is pitching it as a short track specific tire, definitely one that's only going to be raced in bone dry conditions, but it has been raced by Nino Schurter in pretty gnarly stuff. So if you're willing to compromise on puncture protection and you just want a really, 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 really fast cross-country tyre, this is going to be a popular one.
That's a fair shout. With XC courses getting ever more technical, perhaps we're not going to see this so much in the Olympic distance races, but as you say, a surefire contender for the short track races, and if it is in bone dry conditions. Is it an oversimplification when it comes to TPI? You mentioned there's a 170 TPI casing option to say, the higher the TPI figure, the more supple it is, the more grippy it is.
Kind of, yeah. The suppleness is more to do with its ability to deform over imperfection. So I wouldn't say it's not, like, grip is probably more a factor of the the tread design and the compound that's used. But yes, as an overall, I don't know, influencing factor in a tire's performance, higher TPI, more supple, easier to deform, faster rolling, going to be better overall. However, generally, a higher TPI is going to be less sturdy overall. You're not going to get quite as much sidewall support, and it's maybe, I mean, it depends on other factors, as whether there's like a puncture protection there, for example. It's probably a little bit more fragile. So yeah, really specialist option, this one.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to do it a disservice because clearly it is a very good and a very fast tire, but it almost looks like a hybrid tire.
Yeah, it kind of does. Yeah, to be honest, it actually looks like the Maxxis Rambler, I think it's called. I'd need to check that, but they do a really fast gravel race tire. It looks quite a lot like that, but much fatter, and was actually raced incidentally at the Sea Otter Fuego 100XL XE Marathon race to first place by Santa Cruz HT squad rider Keegan Swenson. Quite a gnarly course, but very fast. So yes, already adding to its impressive Palmares, but now it's actually available to buy.
Very fast, very dusty. We didn't get to ride bikes at all at this year's Sea Otter.
No, we didn't. We've done a marathon of content, not racing.
We have. Just whilst we're talking XC, did you see the Vittoria POT when you were out there?
No, I didn't. I looked like I'd been munching the POT in the desert with my bucket hat and my little necktie and glasses. But no, I didn't see the tire while I was there.
What is POT?
It's a hallucinogenic cactus.
I did not know that. Yeah, it's been a long week. It feels like we've all been munching the content POT.
That's very good.
Okay, let's get this back on track. We're going to keep talking tyres, but we're going to move from cross-country to downhill. And this is the reimagination of a classic. So this is a new tyre from Michelin. It's a reimagination of the Comp 16 with the new DH16. So this is a new downhill tyre, Jack.
Yes, the new DH16 replaces the DH34 as Michelin's all-round dry pack downhill racing tyre. Quite a versatile option. And yes, as you mentioned, the Comp 16 was a very much loved downhill tyre. We reviewed it all the way back in the very genesis of Bike Radar in 2007. Can you believe that? By very own Guy Kestvin. Anyway, that tyre was raced a lot in the downhill racing world, and the DH34 builds on that. It's claimed to be around 150 grams lighter than the previous generation tyre and has an 18% improvement in rolling resistance, according to Michelin. One interesting thing on this, it's just something I've never really thought about in tyres, if I'm honest. But according to Michelin, they said the new softer rubber compound is said to maintain consistent performance down to temperatures as low as 3 degrees Celsius. Now, it's quite unusual for downhill races to be run that cold. But the guy I spoke to at Michelin is right in saying that the earlier season does mean that at the top of the mountain, you know, it could be pretty damn cold compared to how warm it might be in the bottom of the valley if someone's racing early in the season. So, like, stability of tyre compound, I don't know, it's just something I've never really given a great deal of thought to. Like, in the road cycling world, you'll sometimes see it with winter tyres, they say, in cold conditions, they stay as grippy. But for mountain biking, yeah, it's just not one I've really thought about before, but fair enough.
We did a video on our YouTube channel last year, I think, last spring, maybe last summer, a real deep dive into compounds and particularly focused on mountain bike tyre compounds. And I think that was mentioned as a factor, but definitely worth going to check that out. We'll include that in the...
Was that a Will Soap video?
It was a Will Soap video.
Oh, it's going to be nerdy then.
Tyre compounds are a particular passion of Will's, but definitely worth going to check that out because there are so many factors that influence your performance, the performance of your tyre compound being a really big one. So go and check that out. We'll include a link to that video in the description to this podcast. But Jack, let's go on to our final pick. And we've covered a lot of new tech, really interesting tech, really nerdy tech here. But this is just a bike. And I say just a bike. It's a bike that simply caught your eye.
What a bike. It was a Cannondale Lab 71 Scalpel. There's a stock build. It was on show on the Ceramic Speed stand. So it was showing off their OSPWX oversized pulley wheel system for SRAM transmission. But otherwise, the frame, the build rather, is just a stock one. And it was so cool. It has this amazing, like, smoky, kind of milky, streaky paint. That sounds dreadful when I'm saying it, but honestly, it's just a really good-looking bike. I really like the look of the Scalpel. I've always thought the Lefty is a very cool fork, but that very, like, subdued but quite creative paint job really, really got me. I thought it was very cool. And actually, one of the, according to the Ceramic Speak guys, one of the very few Lab 71 scalpels that are actually out there in the world. I believe it belongs to one of the guys on that team. Very exclusive bike, full SRAM XX transmission group set, DT Swiss XRC 1200 wheels, a Lefty Ocho 120 fork, a RockShox reverb access, dropper seat post, Ceramic Speed stuff, and full carbon finishing kit. Just a good bike. And if you have any reason to read all of our coverage from this show, let it be this one. It's well worth a look.
Absolutely. This is the bike that perhaps isn't best suited to the audio format. It's best suited to going and having a look at it. It's in Jack's Mountain Bike Roundup, which is on the site right now. Go and check that out. It's Cannondale's stunning Lab 71 scalpel. Really fun and really, really beautiful paint job on this one. Actually, we've got lots more coming when it comes to beautiful bikes from Sea Otter. We've covered lots of nerdy tech, but we're just going to simply have roundups of the best looking bikes at the show that we've seen. But this one, well, this is about as fancy as it gets.
Yes, we're going to have way more as well in terms of mountain bike tech. This has just been a brief taster of some of the mountain bike tech we spotted. There's been a lot of other really cool technical stuff. Quite a few prototype downhill bikes, interestingly, despite the fact Sea Otter isn't really home to a true downhill race, if you like. And I'll be handing over writing all that to people who know a lot more about downhill bikes than me. George and I were much more in our comfort zone with George's roundup of the new and unreleased gravel tech from the likes of Giro, Redshift, Wolftooth, Vittoria, Cane Creek and Cinelli. And you can check out his roundup from today as well. And there's been other news stories published from CR on the site. It's been very, very fun, the trip. As I said in the last podcast, I really enjoyed the trip out here. I'm ready to go home and have a good sleep and not be in a hotel room. But no, it's been a real treat and excellent fun speaking to lots of nice people at the show.
Well, we'll wrap it up there. We've got our 11-hour flight back to London tomorrow morning. A couple of other plugs. Check out our Instagram feed. We've got lots of short snippets from the show with Jack presenting some of the tech highlights from this year's show. A really good way to get quick fire info and just to get a sense of the character of this year. So, and some of our tech highlights. There's also a free hub soundcheck video that you've just published, which was a bit of fun.
Yeah, I was definitely tired and a bit overtired in the sun. And I was wandering around the Scott. Windsor, our social media manager, who's been contenting with me for this week, and in a bit of a hot panic, I was like, let's just film free hubs, it'll make a really good video. And it was very fun. Everyone was very obliging and kind when I was like, could you spin me a screamer, was what my line I was asking them for. Yeah,
well, if you can go and justify Jack's existence on the Bike Radar team by going and watching that video and giving it a like and voting for your favorite free hub sound, because it is a controversial subject. Jack, can you remember what your favorite was?
The Envy was very impressive. It's probably not what I would own. I quite like the Hope, to be honest. The new Hope ones are a bit more subdued. I don't really like a noisy free hub, if I'm honest.
You know, the Envy was like a deep growl of a bear, like a black bear, North American black bear. But yeah, very impressive. Anyway, lots more to come from Sea Otter, lots on the site currently. Go and check out our Instagram. We've got a video coming in the coming days. So go and check that out as well. But Jack, let's get back to London.
Yes, please. Let's go home.
Thank you very much for listening to the Bike Radar podcast. Please leave us a rating and review on your podcast provider of choice. Send us a question or give us some feedback by sending us an email to podcast@bikeradar.com. But otherwise, we'll be back in the comfort of our podcast studio later this week. And we'll be back to normal service on the Bike Radar podcast. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Bike Radar podcast. If you've not done so already, please subscribe and share with your friends. Or leave us a rating if you've enjoyed this episode.